KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The Cold War might be over, but the nuclear weapons and the threat of destruction remains. Joseph Cirincione is the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. He spoke at Town Hall on January 14, 2014, about today's most pressing international security issue and the steps governments are taking to make the world safer.
I am proud to serve on the International Security Advisory Board to Secretary of State Kerry, but the remarks I offer tonight are my opinions alone and do not represent the views of that board, the State Department, or the government, and they're always happy when I say that. I'm the president of Plowshares Fund. We're a foundation that began 32 years ago in San Francisco and now has offices there and in Washington, D.C. We raise money from generous donors, and we give it to the smartest people with the best ideas on how to reduce nuclear threats around the world. We are delighted that we've been able to raise and dispense about $120 million over this period, and we're just getting stronger every year. So if you either have money or need money, please see me after this talk. It's just about everybody. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that none of you woke up this morning thinking about nuclear weapons. And why should you? You know, if you worried about anything when you opened your eyes this morning, maybe it was a personal problem, a family issue, the Seahawks, you know. But of all the problems and challenges we face in our personal lives, our community, our nation, there are only two that threaten destruction on a planetary level: global warming and nuclear weapons. Both of these are caused by machines that we invented. And both of these threaten to destroy almost everything else we've invented, including civilization itself. But both of these are preventable, even reversible. But in order to do that, both of these require new ways of thinking and new leaders willing to take the risks to implement those new ideas. And I say that because in both of these cases, you're faced with opposition to change. You're faced with deniers, people who deny there's a problem, or propose policies that would actually make the situation with each one of them worse. So you have to recognize that with these issues, like so many others, it's not just a policy debate. It's a political struggle. You have to go out there and fight for your ideas because there are people on the other side. People have been fighting over these ideas, over nuclear weapons, since before the bomb began. The group of scientists in Chicago who were working on the Manhattan Project, right before the first nuclear test, wrote a report to President Truman saying, "Don't drop the bomb." We had started the invention of nuclear weapons because we thought Hitler was building a bomb. We wanted to have a deterrent. Nobody thought that we would actually use such a thing. But even after Hitler was defeated, the bureaucratic inertia of the program had grown so strong, and the brutality of the war had grown so deep that dropping this bomb seemed like just another step in an already horrific war where hundreds of thousands of people were killed in fire raids in Dresden and Hamburg and Tokyo. This was just one more weapon. But the difference was that this was one bomb, one plane, destroyed a city. Not hundreds. An incredibly efficient killing machine was born. The scientists' plea, of course, was ignored. They had warned that if we dropped this bomb without a system in place to control its spread, that we would see what they called the flying start to an atomic arms race. And after a bit of delay, that's exactly what happened. Fortunately, today the Cold War is over, but the nuclear weapons remain, and the threats remain. So you may think that these things are weapons of the past, that their arsenals are declining, which they are, that the rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States, which gave rise to the arms race, is a thing of the past, which it is, or that policies are in place that are taking care of these dangers, these threats. If you think that, you're dead wrong. There are real nuclear nightmares out there that threaten us, our family, our state. In fact, nuclear weapons are the only military threat that threaten the territorial integrity of the United States. Nothing else, however terrible, could cause as much damage as even one nuclear weapon on one city. We generally group these threats in three areas: the risk of nuclear terrorism, the risk of new states getting these weapons, and the risk from the existing arsenals of 17,000 nuclear weapons. In Nuclear Nightmares, I talk about President Obama's effort to end these dangers, to reduce these threats. It begins with him taking the podium in Prague in April 2009. I worked on President Obama's 2008 campaign. I was then vice president at the Center for American Progress, vice president for national security. The Center for American Progress was Hillary Clinton supporters as far as you could see. There was a couple of us who snuck off in the corner and joined the Obama campaign, and eventually everybody did. And I'm proud to say that my role was to work on nuclear policy there, and I'm proud to say that Barack Obama had the most comprehensive, coherent, integrated, realistic nuclear policy that anyone has ever carried into the White House. And it was a matter of personal interest for him. He had worked on these issues in the U.S. Senate. He had sought out Dick Lugar, Republican senator from Indiana, and asked him to take him on his next trip to the Ukraine, to Belarus, Kazakhstan, where Lugar was leading the charge to try to secure those loose nukes in those former Soviet republics. He learned a lot on that trip. He has jokes he tells about it. He sought out Chuck Hagel, Republican senator from Nebraska, and together Hagel and Obama wrote the most comprehensive piece of Senate legislation on nonproliferation. So when he goes into the White House, he knew this issue. And he knows the danger, and he wants to do something about this issue, and he thinks it's his moment. So his very first national security speech is about nuclear policy in Prague in April 2009. And he lays it out beautifully. And in Nuclear Nightmares, we give the whole speech. Go read it. It's a thing of beauty. Ben Rhodes, now Deputy National Security Advisor, was one of the craftsmen on this. But as you know by now, President Obama writes his own stuff. And he works on this. And it just this thing just sings. And it sings in part because the policies are integrated. He understands you can't go around playing nuclear whack-a-mole, trying to whack down the next guy who's trying to get the nuclear weapons, or make choices between good guys like Pakistan and say, okay, it's okay for them to have nuclear weapons, and bad guys like North Korea and say, no, no, you can't have them. That policy won't work. You have to have an integrated approach. So he lays it out in that speech, and then over the next couple of years, he starts to implement it. So he starts, for example, the nuclear security summits, bringing together leaders of 50 nations that have nuclear materials, stuff that they might use for civilian purposes, but that can be used to build a bomb, highly enriched uranium that's used for fuel in some research reactors that states have. And not just the states you think about, like Ukraine or Belarus, no, Vietnam, Ghana, Mexico, enough material to build a bomb, and a terrorist won't go to a friendly state, they'll go to the weak link. Where's this stuff the least well-guarded? That's where I'm going to go get it. And in order to corral that, you have to have the cooperation of all these countries, and that's what he forges together in these nuclear security summits. I just today accepted an invitation to go to the next nuclear security summit at the end of March in the Hague, in the Netherlands. It means I have to give up my annual trip to spring training down in Phoenix, where I go watch the Mariners play. My leader here for the Geezer Spring Weekend is very disappointed in me that I'm in my choices that I'm making for this choice, but it's something I feel like I have to do. That you make a choice in life, and this is one of those. So I'm going to go to the Netherlands in March and sort of be one of the NGO advocates pushing the governments to do more faster. But that part of the strategy works pretty well. A new report just came out from the Nuclear Threat Initiative showing that we have reduced the arsenals. We have secured the material. There's been a marked improvement in the security, but we're not done yet. There's still a lot to go. Sam Nunn says we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. And that's how it is. We know what to do. We just have to implement it faster. President Obama then, in April, talked about the need to stop the new programs that were developing in North Korea and Iran. We often talk about countries like Iran and North Korea, but there are no countries like Iran and North Korea. There's only Iran and North Korea. There are no other countries that have programs like this. North Korea has enough material for maybe 6 nuclear weapons and is on the verge of consolidating as a nuclear weapon state. Iran doesn't have a bomb. The national security agencies are unanimous, saying that Iran does not have a bomb program like the Manhattan Project. And the leadership has not decided to build a nuclear weapon yet, but they are acquiring the technology that could allow them to build a weapon sometime in the future should they decide to do so. So this is a threat. This is a problem. But if you can stop this, if you can stop Iran from getting a weapon, if you can contain and even roll back the North Korean problem, you're really, as I say in the book, looking at the end of proliferation. This wave of proliferation that began with Hiroshima, and that we once had 25, 30 countries exploring nuclear weapons programs or acquiring nuclear weapons. We're now at the end of that wave. You can stop Iran and North Korea. You really are making a major step in ending one of those threats. But to do that, you need a lot of cooperation from a lot of people. It's not something that one nation can do. And that brings us to the third threat, and this is what Obama laid out as well. You have to lead the countries with the most weapons, particularly the United States, the country that invented the bomb, that used the bomb, that built the best bombs in the world. We have to lead. It's impossible to maintain a position that says it's okay for me to have them, it's not okay for you. It's like trying to get your kids not to smoke when you have a 3-pack-a-day habit. It's not going to happen. So the U.S. and Russia, the two largest arsenals in the world, together they have 95% of all the nuclear weapons in the world. They have to take the lead, and we did that with the new START treaty, and I'm proud that Plowshares Fund had an organized campaign to support the passage of that treaty. It was a fight in the U.S. Senate. Came down to the last day of December 2010 before the Senate gave its approval for what should have been a slam dunk approval. And this all works together. You have to show that you, with the nuclear weapons, are decreasing your arsenals in order to get the international cooperation that prevent their spread and secure their materials. And you have to prevent their spread and secure their materials in order to build up the security that you need for countries to continue to get rid of their nuclear weapons. So disarmament, non-proliferation, they're two sides of the same coin. And you keep flipping that over and over again. You keep making progress. And that's the kind of progress we've been making. And here's the really, really good news. We are getting there. Nuclear weapons are steadily declining in value, in numbers, in locales around the world. At the height of the Cold War, we had almost 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world. We're down to 17,000. In the 1980s, countries like Argentina and Brazil had nuclear weapons programs. Iran was just started one. Libya was experimenting with one. You've seen these programs steadily go down, and many, many more countries have given up nuclear weapons and programs in the last 25 years than have tried to acquire them. So you know you're making progress. It's steadily going down. The question is, can we continue that? Can we do it fast enough before something truly terrible happens? And can we continue to be the leaders in this?
Joseph Cirincione, the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. He spoke at Town Hall on January 14th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. And you can follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Joseph Cirincione in a moment, 921, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow morning, a review of the week's news with Robert Mack, reporter, political analyst, former host of King TV's Upfront, and the principal at SeattleTopStory.com. Knut Berger, the Moss back at Crosscut.com and blogger at Seattle Magazine. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire. Planned discussion topics include hearings in Olympia on competing gun bills, the State of the Union address, Seahawks coach Pete Carroll saying the NFL should allow its players to use medical marijuana, and Seattle City Council member Sawant taking a voluntary pay cut. It's all tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Forecast for tonight, lows mid to upper 30s, showers decreasing overnight, Friday highs lower to mid 40s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting A Great Wilderness, a new play about religion, sexual orientation, and aging, playing through February 16th. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Nuclear weapons are still a threat to national security. Joseph Cirincione is the president of Plowshares Foundation. He's also the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. In it, he describes Pakistan as the most dangerous state on Earth, discusses the threat of North Korea, and assesses the Obama administration's nuclear policies. Cirincione spoke at Town Hall on January 14th, 2014.
Well, even if you are not that worried about the threats I just described, even if you think, well, they're kind of abstract, the chance of any of that happening is very small, here's another threat that you should consider. It's the fiscal threat. Ash Carter, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, was at a conference I was out in Aspen. It's part of the perks of this job. You get to go to conferences in Aspen. And he said, nuclear weapons don't cost that much. You know, and he gave a quote of, about $12 billion a year for Department of Defense. Well, it turns out Ash Carter, a very smart man, I've known Ash for a long time, was grossly underestimating the cost of nuclear weapons and looking only at one small part of it. The Congressional Budget Office just came out with their first ever estimate of how much we spend on nuclear weapons. And they totaled up the 10-year costs of nuclear weapons. So all the nuclear weapons programs, plus related programs like missile defense, which you only have to defend against nuclear weapons, $570 billion over the next 10 years. $570 billion will be spent by the U.S. government on these nuclear weapons and programs. But that is actually just the tip of the iceberg. This Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute came out just last week with a more comprehensive study looking at just the cost for the nuclear weapons programs. How much does it cost to replace our triad, the missiles and bombers and submarines that we have? These are all built during the Cold War. They were modernized during the Reagan period. We started replaced all these. And they're now reaching the end of their operational life. And the cost for replacing, for replicating this Cold War arsenal, $1 trillion. $1 trillion, their report is called the $1 trillion triad, over the next 40 years. So do you want to do that? Is that where you think we should spend $1 trillion? Is that going to make you safer? Is that going to provide your security? Is that going to allow you to spend the money on the things that you really need for your security? And I'm not talking about domestic programs, I just mean in the defense budget, because the defense budget is coming down. The joint chiefs don't mind spending money on missile defense and nuclear weapons as long as the budget's going up. But when it starts to contract, as it is now, when the troops come home from Iraq and Afghanistan, when support for large, large military budgets starts to shrink, when we stop, instead of doubling the military budget as we have over the last 10 years, when we cut it in half, what do you choose then? The Navy is already warning about this. The Navy has a plan to build a new submarine, a new nuclear-armed submarine. It's called to replace the Tridents, the SSBNX, it's called. Over the life of that program, it will cost $350 billion just for the sub, about $100 billion to build it, another billions of dollars to operate and maintain it, $350 billion. And the head of the Navy warned in congressional testimony last year that while they were building that sub, they wouldn't be able to build conventional ships. They have a fixed budget, and they have a plan for how many conventional ships they want. It would cost them something like 40 conventional ships while they were building the SSBNX. So their answer to that is that somebody else should pay for the new nuclear-armed sub. They want the Department of Defense to pay for it, not the Navy. Department of Defense says, no way. That's not going to happen. So we see this crisis coming, this budget crunch coming, where people are going to have to choose. And I think the people of Washington State have to choose, too. If Washington State was an independent nation, you would be the third largest nuclear power in the world. You have 8 Trident subs based up at Bangor. They each have 24 tubes, 24 missiles in them. Each missile carries, on average, 4 warheads. That's about 652 warheads. Plus, you have another 652 in reserve. So you have about 1,300-1,400 nuclear weapons here. That's more than any other country on Earth except the United States and Russia. The rest of the countries in the world number their nuclear weapons in dozens. France has about 300, Great Britain about 200, China about 200, India, Pakistan about 100, Israel about 100, etc. So you see the size of the arsenal we have. Is that where we should be spending our money? Are those the programs that we really need? Is this in Washington State's interest? I don't think it is. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a union man. I don't want to see union jobs cut. I'm a member of SEIU, the faculty at Georgetown University. I used to be a member of the Operating Engineers. I know what a good-paying job means to the person who has that job, to the family, to the neighbors. So you don't want to cut those jobs. But is there another way to create those jobs? Is there something more socially useful that could be done in Washington State to create the several thousand jobs that this $200 million a year, roughly, brings to Washington State? Is there something else we can do? So it's not just a moral issue, which I think it is. It's an economic issue. Is this the best use of our federal dollars? Is this the best use of our state dollars? And I think the same goes for the people of Montana. There's 150 ICBMs up in Montana. We've been having some serious problems with the morale in the IBM force. Highly qualified Air Force officers who were still pulling 24-hour, 36-hour shifts in underground bunkers, getting ready on a minute's notice to push a button they know they're never going to push. What kind of job is that? It's a dead-end job, and they know it. This used to be the part of a career ladder where you'd go and you'd be Curtis LeMay. You know, who was the head of the Strategic Air Command. And you would run for president, vice president. The head of the Strategic Command doesn't go anywhere these days. It's a dead-end job. It's a dying industry. Can we convince the leaders of Montana to cash in this chip of declining value for another revenue stream, another mission for the base, something more useful, something more practical? Can we convince the laboratories in Livermore, in California, in Los Alamos, and Sandia to take the talent they have, the computing power they have, the physics knowledge they have, and apply it to something that the country needs, not obsolete weapons from the last century that we're never going to use? Now, I personally believe that we can get rid of nuclear weapons, that the only way to make sure they're never used is to drum them out of existence the way we got rid of chemical weapons, the way we got rid of biological weapons. Every major nation in the world used to have a big chemical arsenal, a big biological weapons arsenal. These are now considered taboo, beyond the pale. No civilized nation would ever use them. We're getting rid of one of the last remaining chemical weapons arsenals as we speak. Chemical weapons are being moved out of Syria in a civil war and put on ships for disposal at sea. It's remarkable. It was considered impossible to do this at the beginning of September. By the end of December, it was happening. Syria's chemical weapon is being destroyed. If we can do it with chemical and biological, I think we can do it with nuclear, but you might not agree. I understand. So let's say we keep a few. I can't think of a military mission that requires one nuclear weapon. We haven't had one since 45. And we've been in lots of wars, had lots of crises, had lots of risks. We've lost wars, and we've never used a nuclear weapon. But let's say we need one. Okay, 10. 50. I don't know any, I can't imagine using 50 nuclear weapons, but I'll give you 500. Let's keep 500 nuclear weapons. We have 5,000. So you see the scale of the problem. You see how much you can cut, how the excess that still exists in our arsenals, and all of this costs billions and billions of dollars. So that's what we do. That's what this book is about. How you can cut, where you can cut, the politics of how you cut, who are the people that don't want to cut. But let's take a real live, historic, current problem to illustrate what we can do here and what's possible. Iran. I'm going to spend the last 15 minutes of my talk, I'm going to talk a little longer than 30 minutes, on Iran. We now have gotten used to the Secretary of State talking to the Foreign Minister of Iran, but that hadn't happened in 34 years before September. We're now used to U.S. officials talking routinely to Iranian officials, to having negotiations with Iranian officials over their program, but that hadn't happened since the Shah was deposed in 1979. For the first time in 10 years, the Iranian government has just agreed to freeze its nuclear program, to freeze it in place. This was the arrangement that was reached right before Thanksgiving. That was, the details were all worked out and was just announced yesterday. And it will go into effect January 20th. I think there's a game that day. It goes into effect January 20th, and that's when the program will freeze. What does this mean? There's a couple of students in the audience, so I'm going to take just a minute to give a quick physics and chemistry lesson so you understand what the problem is with Iran and what we're doing about it. Iran is one of the few countries in the world, not just that has a nuclear reactor, but it's enriching uranium. It's making the fuel for the reactor. Most countries that have reactors buy the fuel from countries that have already produced it, United States, Canada, Russia, others, Europe, that produce it. Iran says it wants to make its own. So it has built centrifuges. Centrifuges look like this. They look like water heaters. They're about the size of a person, a little thin. They're made of a strong alloy to handle the pressures. And it's designed to enrich uranium. The way this process begins, Iran goes to its uranium mines, which they have, and they take the uranium out of the ground. They then crush it up in mills at the mines and get rid of all the rocks and stuff until you just have the powdered form of uranium. It's a fine powder. It's often yellow in color, so it's called yellow cake. So that's the refined uranium. You take that to a facility, in this case, one in Isfahan. I visited this facility in 2005 in Isfahan. And you combine it with fluorine gas, and you turn it into a gas. And the reason you're doing this is because you're trying to get more of a particular isotope of uranium. When you take that uranium out of the ground, 99.3% of it is a perfectly nice isotope of uranium called U-238. But it's U-235. Only 0.7%, only 7 out of 1,000 atoms are U-235. That's the one you want. That's the one that goes pop. You hit that thing with the neutron, it splits in half. It shoots out a spray of other neutrons that can hit other close by U-235 atoms. And then this miracle happens. In the fission process, a very small amount of that uranium atom is transformed from matter into energy. And when you plug that into Einstein's equation, the only equation most of us know, E equals mc squared, you realize that matter times c, the speed of light squared, is a very large number. So you have a very small amount of matter produces a very large amount of energy. Normal chemical energy, the breaking and forming of electron bonds that are what turns the oxygen into energy in our lungs or turns dynamite into an explosion, that chemical energy is 2 or 3 electron volts. A nuclear exchange, the nuclear energy is 200 million electron volts. So you get the idea here. So this is what you're after. So now you've got to get those 235 atoms close together. So you take that gas and you put it in the centrifuge and you spin it around at supersonic speeds, and every student knows the heavier elements goes to the outside, and you siphon off the gas in the center. So it's a little lighter. The 235 is in a little higher concentration, and you take that out. And now you have maybe 8 atoms per thousand. So it's a little enriched in U-235. But that's not getting you very far, so you got to do it again. So you hook this other centrifuge up, and you line up 10,000 of these centrifuges, and you do this for 3 to 4 months. And now when you stop, now you have uranium that's enriched to maybe 3%, 5%. 5% U-235, you can stop right there. You take out the gas, you turn the gas into a powder form called an oxide, you hammer that oxide into little pellets, you put the pellets into fuel rods, you put the fuel rods into a reactor, they get hot, real hot. They turn the water around them into steam, the steam drives the turbines, and you have electricity. 20% of the electricity in the United States comes from nuclear energy produced in just this way. Iran says that's all they're doing. They just want nuclear energy like the big boys. They want to sell their oil and gas, not burn it for electricity. What's wrong with that? Do you trust them? Do you trust them? Well, of course we don't. Because they've hidden their program. They've lied about their program. They secretly were building these uranium enrichment facilities. And then we caught them and they tried to secretly build them again. We have pretty good evidence that they were doing weapons work in the 80s and 90s. The intelligence estimate is that they stopped doing that, but now the weapons program, you might say, is in plain sight. They're just building up the facility, building up the ability to make the material, and you are worried that they are starting off with fuel, but they'll end up with bomb grade. Because if you just keep taking those centrifuges and spinning them, you can get to 20% enriched. Different kind of fuel. They have a research reactor in Tehran that we sold them that uses 20% enriched uranium, and if you keep going just a little bit longer, it goes to 90%. You can stop right there. You can take out that gas. You can forge it into a metal about the size of an orange, and you have the core of a bomb. So that's the problem. How do you let them do a little bit of enrichment for fuel but stop them from turning that into a bomb? One solution is you don't let them do anything. The zero option. Like Rome did to Carthage. You go raise it and you salt the ground and you never let them do this again. That's what Benjamin Netanyahu proposes. That's what members of Congress propose. There's a bill in Congress right now that's trying to define success as that, as zero. The only way we can be sure that Iran is not building a bomb is if it's zero, if they can't do squat. But there's not a politician in Iran who could accept that deal. Maybe they could have accepted it in 2003 when they didn't have any centrifuges spinning, when they came and wanted to talk, when they started negotiation with the Europeans to settle this issue. But the U.S. didn't want to negotiate. Maybe we could have got that deal in 2005 when they gave us a proposal to talk about this, to talk about their relations with Israel, their support for Hezbollah, the whole schmear. But the U.S. didn't want to talk. The Bush administration had a different policy. In the words of Vice President Cheney, we don't negotiate with evil, we destroy it. And that policy backfired horribly. They went from 0 centrifuges at the beginning of the Bush administration to 8,000 by the end, and they're still building. So now you can't get that zero deal. There's too much national pride. There's billions of dollars invested. There's support across the political spectrum. So now you got to find a way to walk them back, a face-saving way out, where they will accept strict limits on the number of centrifuges, on the location of the centrifuges, on the quality of the gas produced, on the inspection regime, and that's what this interim agreement does. It freezes it in place. It says you can only enrich to 5% and no more. And that stockpile of 20% that you've built up, we're going to take that away from you. You're going to convert it into a form that can't be used for weapons. You cannot install any more centrifuges while we're negotiating. You cannot build any more centrifuges while we're negotiating. You can't do any work on that Arak, A-R-A-K, reactor that you're building over there that might produce plutonium, another source of bomb material. Stop. It's a giant pause button that we've just hit. The debate is whether to keep that pause going and allow time for the negotiations and to be able to get at the end of that negotiation with a package that limits the program but doesn't eliminate it and puts intrusive inspections on. And if we can do that, we will have a deal. The opposition in Congress is from senators who, A, don't want a deal, who are still with the Bush program. They want to overthrow the regime, not bargain with it, and they're willing to go to war to overthrow that regime, and B, with some people who believe that the only reason Iran's negotiating is sanctions, so let's pour some more sanctions on. Today, you had editorials in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in the Atlantic, in Bloomberg News, in USA Today, in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that said, don't screw this up. Senate, back off. Back off. Give diplomacy a chance. We've tried your way for the last 10 years. Look where we are. Give peace a chance. Let diplomacy work for 6 months. If it doesn't work, you can put more sanctions on now, but don't blow it.
Joseph Cirincione, the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. He spoke at Town Hall on January 14th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. And you can follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Joseph Cirincione in a moment. 943, 94.9 KUOW. This week's edition of Radiolab is titled Desperately Seeking Symmetry. It's described as a search for order and balance in the world and how symmetry shapes our existence. The show includes a quest for love in ancient Greece, a visit to modern-day Princeton to look inside our brains, and an unlikely headline from the Oval Office, circa 1979. Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Lows mid to upper 30s tonight, says the forecast. Showers decreasing overnight. Friday highs lower to mid 40s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Three-time Emmy Award winner Elaine Stritch, Broadway star and film and television actress, joins Michael Feinstein for some musical highlights and candid revelations about her life and career, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Alaska Airlines, with nonstop flights from Seattle to sunny destinations like Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Palm Springs. More information, including vacation packages, at alaskaair.com.
Now is a great time of year to donate your used car, truck, boat, or other vehicle to KUOW. It's easy. Just call 1-866-KUOW-CAR to make a tax-deductible donation of your used vehicle, or get started online at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Today, nine nations have 17,000 nuclear weapons. A recent deal with Iran has paused that nation's nuclear program, but can it be stopped permanently? Joseph Cirincione is the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. He's also the president of Plowshares Foundation, and he spoke about national security at Town Hall on January 14th. Next, he begins talking about the Iran bill.
Senators are under a lot of pressure to sign on to the so-called Iran sanctions bill that, if passed, would destroy the negotiations, would end the negotiations. The two senators from Washington State have not signed that bill. but they're under a tremendous pressure to do so. One of the leaders of this bill is Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who's a leader in pushing this bill, and he convinced his fellow, his junior Senator Bob Corker, to sign on as well. So you have a number of senators, and particularly senators who were in close races this year in 2014, Democrats have signed on. All Republicans except two have signed on to the bill. That's 43 Republicans and 16 Democrats, who are at 59. You want to stop it there. You don't want this thing to get any further away. So there's a big fight on right now. It's happening right now. And here's what's at stake. I'm going to wrap up here. It's not just the possibility of stopping the Iranian nuclear program. It's the possibility of forging an entirely new relationship with Iran. It's not very often that you can watch the hinge of history move, but we may be at such a moment. Because if you can solve this nuclear program, if you can solve this, the toughest part of the U.S.-Iranian conflict, it opens a door for resolution of possibly other issues. There are overlapping strategic interests that the U.S. and Iran both have. We both have an interest in stabilizing Afghanistan. Iran worked with the United States to overthrow the Taliban in 2001. They don't want to see it come back. We both have an interest in stabilizing Iraq. We both have an interest in making sure that Al-Qaeda doesn't have Syria become a base for its operation. We both have an interest in stopping this Sunni-Shia rift that is tearing up the Muslim world. We're never going to be BFFs with Iran. We're always going to have strategic opposition to their policies. We are ideologically in different worlds. But so was Nixon and Mao. So were Reagan and Gorbachev. But they found a way to manage the differences, not resolve them, not overcome them, not ignore them, but manage them, that led to a negotiated diplomatic settlement of some of these differences and allow the two sets of strategic interests to intersect and both advance. That's the kind of thing we might be looking at with Iran. And that makes some people in the area nervous. That's exactly what they don't want. Whenever there's change, the people who are closest to the change get nervous. The Saudis, the Israelis, are afraid that an improved U.S.-Iran relationship will come at their cost, at their loss. So that's why you see John Kerry spending so much time in those other capitals, reassuring them along the way that it's a win-win situation, but it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a fight. I think we're going to win this fight. Plowshares is right in the middle of it. We are going to spend about $3 million over the next 6 months trying to advance a diplomatic solution to this. We're funding dozens of organizations. We're coordinating these groups in Washington. We are in this to win it. And I'm very optimistic about our ability. Some people think it's impossible to eliminate nuclear weapons, to eliminate these decades-old conflicts. But you and I, we've lived long enough to see the impossible happen. It turns out when people say something's impossible, what they mean is that it's really hard. That it's really, really hard. But we've seen the impossible. I've seen the Vietnam War end, Vietnam unite, and welcome back the people who bombed it in the spirit of friendship and reconciliation. I've seen the people of Eastern Europe overthrow oppressive regimes that had held them in their grasp for decades. I've seen the Soviet Union collapse. I've seen Germany unite. I've seen Catholics and Protestants who swore never, never, never join hands in a unity government. I've seen a man walk out of a prison cell that kept him for 28 years to become elected the president of a free and majority-ruled South Africa. I've seen the team with the worst offensive line in the National Football League advance to the championship game next Sunday. So don't tell me this is impossible. It's just really, really hard. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you tonight. Let's take some questions. I'm sorry I talked for so long. Let's go. We have mics in the audience.
If Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon, why have they not long since done it? Pakistan did it.
Yeah.
India did it. Israel did it. China did it.
Yeah.
Maybe North Korea has done it. Why can't they?
Well, that is
I'm not sure they really want to.
Well, that is an excellent point. I'll say two quick things about it. The Shah started the nuclear program in Iran. He had a plan to build 20 reactors. He had a plan to enrich uranium. We said, okay. He had a plan to reprocess plutonium. We said, okay, why don't you do it with Pakistan? Great idea. This was Kissinger and Scowcroft and Rumsfeld back in the 70s. He was overthrown. The Ayatollah Khomeini shut it down. He said, it's Western technology. We want no part of it. It's part of their ideology, an autocracy.
That's right.
Then Iraq invaded Iran in 1981, and then Iraq attacked Iran with chemical weapons, killing thousands of Iranians, and the world did nothing. We, the United States, vetoed the UN Security Council resolution condemning those chemical weapons attacks. That's when they turned it back on. That's when they started to go for a nuclear weapon. But then the war ended. And the war kind of drifted around, and it went on at low levels, but it was never a dedicated program because they didn't really need it. There wasn't a compelling security risk that required them to do it. You might say there's a compelling security risk now, and that security risk is us, that we are going to attack them. That's the reason almost every country in the world has ever gotten a nuclear weapon, to stop someone else from attacking it, not to use it. But I personally think that Iran is playing a bigger game, that the election of Rouhani in June by the people of Iran signaled a strategic shift in Iran, that there is a new consensus in the majority view, I shouldn't say consensus, among the Iranian elite, that they've got to get the economy going, that they've got to restore Iran's role in the region. The region is in chaos. A nuclear weapon is not going to help you with that. So I think in order to get the economy going, they've got to end the sanctions. In order to end the sanctions, they've got to make a deal on the nuclear program. I think they care a lot less about this nuclear program than we think they do. I think it's kind of an albatross for them right now, and they're willing to deal it. So let's test that proposition. That's what the next 6 months is about. I don't know if that analysis is true, but let's test it. Because as you say, if they really wanted a bomb, they would have had one by now.
One other question. You mentioned the cost of the nuclear industry, the nuclear weapons industry. And here in Washington State, we have the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and the federal government is spending $2 billion a year, sometimes much more than that, and is making virtually no progress on cleaning the mess up. And it's enormous and huge.
Yeah. There is a group here in town called Hanford Challenge, and I encourage you to go to their website and find out about them. And there are some representatives. Can you raise your hand, people who are here from Hanford Challenge? Somebody there in the back? There you go. Thank you very much. Go talk to him at the – oh, you too. A plant! So it's one of the great unsolved problems of nuclear power and of nuclear weapons, the waste issue. We do not know what to do with it. So we just store it, and we store it poorly, and it gets into our groundwater, and it gets into our soil, and it gets into our mother's milk. This is a really serious unsolved problem. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, you're right. I don't wake up in the morning thinking about how many...
Talk a little closer to the mic, please. I got that, though.
You're right. I don't wake up in the morning thinking about how many nuclear warheads are out there all spread around the world, and probably in each of the states, too. A lot of the states in the United States here. But I hear Helen Caldicott talk every once in a while about Fukushima, and that scares me a lot. Could you say a few words about Fukushima and the threat that it poses should I wake up scared every morning? I don't really know what to do about that.
There are 103 nuclear reactors in the United States. Most of them have operated safely and without incident. There have been some notable exceptions to that. The Plowshares Fund does not work on nuclear power. Our board has different opinions on nuclear power. Some of our board think it's a pact with the devil. Others think that it is a necessary component to solve global warming, that you're going to need a healthy nuclear wedge in the energy mix over the next 50 years in order to reduce carbon emissions. So we don't take a position. However, we do note that there are three unsolved problems of nuclear power: safety, If you have an accident at a coal plant, you have an accident that's terrible. If you have an accident at Fukushima, you have a regional disaster with national and international implications. The Japanese have now shut down most of their 52 reactors. The public doesn't want them open again. This is a huge problem. There is a continuing... You have the problem of pollution, which is unsolved. We don't know what to do with the waste. You have an accident like this. It is a huge catastrophe. And you have the issue of proliferation. That is quite... many of the technologies involved in nuclear power can be transferred to nuclear weapons production, as I just explained. That's the situation with Iran. Iran says they have a peaceful nuclear program, but you can see how you can slip from one to the other. So our view in Plowshares is that whatever you do, whatever you decide to do with nuclear power, in your rush to solve one global threat, don't make the other one worse.
Joseph Cirincione, the author of Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. He spoke at Town Hall on January 14th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. And you can follow us on Twitter at kuowspeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Citizen University, hosting a national conference on the art of powerful citizenship, March 21st, 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Seattle Center, featuring Ai-Jen Poo, Zach Silk, and many more. Registration at citizenuniversity.us. 958 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. The theme of To the Best of Our Knowledge this week is crime stories, and not just American ones. Why are millions of British TV viewers obsessed with the Danish TV show The Killing, and will Americans ever get to see the original? A conversation with the show's creator. Also, crime fiction from India, a reading from Kishwar Desai's award-winning novel Witness the Night. And why are there so few detective novels written in Hebrew? An explanation from Israeli crime fiction writer D.A. Mishani. It's all tomorrow evening at 9. Tomorrow evening on LiveWire, A.M. Holmes, author of The End of Alice and the Salman Rushdie-approved May We Be Forgiven. Also Kevin Berry, Irish author of short stories and the 2011 novel City of Bohane. And Michael Hurst, composer, multi-instrumentalist, and writer, all recorded with a live audience in Portland, Oregon. Tomorrow evening at 8. Forecast for tonight, lows mid to upper 30s, showers decreasing overnight. Friday highs lower to mid 40s, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.